Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. We're at the dawn of a new year and a new decade, but many of the challenges we face sound familiar. Responding to an attempted act of terrorism on an airliner, reconciling differing views on healthcare legislation, getting the U.S. economy back on track, and preparing for important congressional and gubernatorial elections. Joining me in the studio to talk about the outlook for 2010, E.J. Dionne at the Washington Post and the Brookings Institution, and Norm Ornstein of the American Enterprise Institute. Joining us from Charlottesville, Larry Sabato. He's founder and director of the Center for Politics at the University of Virginia. Good morning and a Happy New Year to all of you.
Happy New Year to you. Diane.
And indeed, Happy New Year to our listeners. I welcome you, as always, to the program. Call us on 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. You can also join us through Facebook and Twitter. E.J. Dionne, let me start with you. You said in your last column of 2009 that the past 10 years are going to be seen as a time when the United States badly lost its way. Talk about what you mean.
Well, I argued that the decade just ended is going to be one of the most politically consequential, the decade we're going to argue about for a long time. And there have been other decades like that. The 60s are one example. The 80s are another example. And in my mind, we sort of made two critical errors that we'll probably pay for a long time. And I know everything I'm about to say is controversial, which is why we're going to argue about that decade. You know, number one, on the economic front, we decided to fight two wars and cut taxes twice, which is not a great path to fiscal responsibility. And we allowed an economic housing bubble to grow. We didn't. We continued to deregulate markets, and we saw the results. And then we responded to the catastrophe of 9/11 not only by fighting the war in Afghanistan, which was a retaliation most Americans approved of, but then by spending all these resources, particularly the lives of young Americans in Iraq, which I believe will has weakened us rather than strengthened us. And obviously we'll be arguing about that. And so I think that affects the politics of the next 10 years, because to a very large degree, when you look at some of President Obama's toughest critics, they also tend to be President Bush's staunchest defenders, and that there is, I think on their part, I think their opposition is sincere. They disagree with him. But also, I think if Obama is successful, he was elected as the anti-Bush, as the Bush cleanup squad. And if he's successful, it'll complete the rebuke to Bush, much as FDR completed the rebuke to Herbert Hoover. Again, I don't want to ascribe that as the only motive President Obama's critics have, but I think it's an important piece of the puzzle.
E.J. Dionne, the Washington Post and the Brookings Institution. Norman Ornstein, you've looked at certainly the last decade very carefully. Now, as we look forward thus far, how would you say that President Obama has responded thus far to these challenges?
Well, one of the interesting things, Diane, is that, of course, President Obama's approval rating is not horrible, but it's a bit below 50%, which is not where you want to be. Congress's approval is really in the dumper. And it's interesting because if you really step back and look at what happened in the first year of the Obama administration, we got an enormous amount of policy outputs out there, and we're poised to do a lot more. The stimulus package, much reviled, was more than just a stimulus package. It involved a substantial number of policy advances, including things like health information technology that had been sitting there for 10 years unable to get through, an expansion of children's health insurance, very substantial changes in energy and environmental policy through that package, plus a lot that will continue to happen. We got the Lilly Ledbetter Act. We got a very substantial advance on health care. We got a lot done on education, actually, including through the stimulus package. So there was a lot done there, but the public didn't see it. And, of course, partly they didn't see it because we have an economy that continues to be extraordinarily sluggish with unemployment. We got used to unemployment in the 4 or 5% range, and then it went up over 10%, and because of the bickering in our politics, which continue. And the area where President Obama, I think, has failed to make progress, and if anything, we've slid a bit backwards, is the terrible partisan and ideological divide, and what's turned the system into an approximation of a parliamentary system, an opposition that votes in unison against no matter what. But we don't have a parliamentary system, and that makes it very difficult. It's extraordinary in a dysfunctional atmosphere like this that you could make the policy advances that we've had, but the price has been fearsome.
Norman Ornstein, he's resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, and Larry Sabato. On that issue of partisanship, President Obama, then candidate Obama, campaigned on this issue of nonpartisanship, trying to bring people together. As Norm has said, there has been a lot done, but it's been done in a very partisan way. How do you see 2010 unfolding as these members of Congress come back together?
Well, Diane, I think it'll be even more partisan, if that's possible, because it's an election year. And I think President Obama, while he was right to try and strike that note of bipartisanship and to reach out his hand, it really is an impossibility under our current system, in part because of the polarization that's taken place in the two parties. You no longer have any substantial liberal wing in the Republican Party. In fact, you don't have a wing at all. You can't even see a feather on the left side on the Republican in the Republican Party. And on the Democratic side, of course, what was once a large conservative delegation, mainly from the South and the border states, no longer exists either. So you have a fundamentally conservative Republican Party, a moderate to liberal Democratic Party. They don't see eye to eye on just about everything. And that makes it very difficult for any president, Democrat or Republican, to reach across the aisle, to find common ground. And so many of these issues that we're facing are deeply divisive. And in an election year, it's just going to be worse. Everything's cyclical, and we've been through so many of these election cycles. And when we have a presidentially centric system, when you have a Democratic president, especially in times of economic dislocation, you're going to have Republican gains in the Congress and probably in the gubernatorial core. And we'll overinterpret that election and pretend that it says something about 2012 when it won't. But that's all for the future.
Larry Sabato, he's founder and director of the Center for Politics at the University of Virginia. Larry, one of your most recent books is titled A More Perfect Constitution. Now, there's been some talk about reshaping the way, for example, that the Senate operates in order to get past this issue of total partisanship. How likely do you think that might be?
Oh, not very likely. I don't want to be too pessimistic, and EJ and Norm are there inside the Beltway, and they can correct me if I'm wrong. But I suspect they agree with me on this. In that book, A More Perfect Constitution, I proposed a series of fairly radical constitutional revisions to try to stir the pot and to get people to think about how government ought to be and how the mousetrap perhaps ought to be redesigned and rebuilt. I proposed a restructuring of the Senate that's more representative of the country. It's really stunning when you think about it. 17% of the American public elects 51 senators, a majority of the Senate, and just 11% of the population elects 41 senators. You only need 41 to sustain a filibuster, at least for major items. And there are other ways to do it. There have been a lot of proposals to restructure the filibuster rule so that you require fewer senators to shut off unlimited debate as time goes on, and I think that's a reasonable approach, too. But on the whole, I doubt any of it changes. I got a very positive reaction to my book from people who have no power. I got a very, very negative reaction, or I think a realistic, semi-cynical reaction from those who know how the system works and understand that we're not going to have any of those basic changes, unfortunately.
DJ.
I guess speaking as one of those who has no power, I was very sympathetic to these ideas, particularly the Senate. I think the problems with the Senate really came into sharp relief this year precisely because you had the uniform front of Republican opposition that Norm described earlier, where even Senator Olympia Snowe, probably the most moderate of the lot, decided in the end for a variety of reasons, and she came under enormous pressure from her Republican colleagues. Even she couldn't vote for a health care bill that in many ways was along lines that she was sympathetic to. When you have not a single Republican voting for with the Democrats on anything, the problems of blocking legislation and then forcing this partisan parliamentary majority really come to the fore. And we forget the Senate was created when there were 13 colonies, former colonies, becoming states. And willy-nilly over our history, we created states of various sizes. It is extremely undemocratic that to pick four states that Wyoming and Idaho have as many representatives in the Senate as New York and California. It's a very odd system.
E.J. Dionne, the Brookings Institution and the Washington Post. When we come back, we'll talk about the future of healthcare reform in conference. And welcome back. I know as we try to look forward, it's always hard because people want to look back, and there is always this dispute, EJ, about is this the first year of the new decade or is it the last year of the old decade?
Right. A lot of knowledgeable readers apparently have written, listeners rather, have listened, have written us saying actually it's next year. We're in the zero year
right
now. I am agnostic on this, but I think it's more convenient to declare the last decade over.
Larry Sabato.
Well, I actually favor us having one additional year to the decade, in part so that we have another year to make sense of it. There was no year zero, so I think the decade ends December 31st, 2010, but I don't think it's a major problem compared to everything else we're facing.
Exactly.
I think it's been such an awful decade, I'm ready to declare an end no matter what year it is.
All right, Norm, let's talk about healthcare and when we can expect to return to that discussion.
Well, Diane, oddly enough, Congress has decided to take much of January off. They're exhausted.
Is this normal?
It is normal, but it's not appropriate, I think, actually. Having said that, the process of reconciling the House and Senate versions of the health care bill is going on intensely now because it's basically being done by a handful of people. It's the leaders and a couple of the committee chairs and other powerhouses who are sitting down and trying to pull together the House and Senate versions. The Senate doesn't come back really until they have a pro forma session tomorrow, and then they'll be back about the 19th of January. The goal here is to get a bill together and done before the State of the Union.
And do we know that date yet?
We don't know the date yet.
And is that why?
Yeah, I think, well, you know, often we don't get the date of the State of the Union until sometime in mid-January. But I suspect that they're going to, if they're this close, they're going to wait so that the president can declare the triumph then. There's a, you know, the odds remain extraordinarily high that we're going to get a health care bill passed and done sometime within the next 6 or 8 weeks.
But the big issues on the table, abortion, what else?
Well, we've still got questions about how you're going to resolve the controversy over the so-called public option. You've got a lot of people upset about that. Abortion remains an extremely key issue. How you fund this package, and that includes whether you put a tax on the so-called Cadillac plans, deeply opposed by labor, but supported by virtually every healthcare analyst from left to right. What kind of package you come up with to tax the rich to do this. But there are also real questions about how much you build in elements to bend the cost curve, as they say. And the House bill has some very good, tough provisions and some very good ways of extending coverage to reduce the burden on low-income people who face a real dilemma under these bills, where you're going to be required to have insurance, but if the cost is too high, you either have to pay a punitive tax or too much a share of your income.
Now,
if we can get past that, we could end up with a better bill, and that may well happen.
EJ, here's an email from Roger in Ann Arbor, Michigan. He says, I want you folks to know that over the weekend, I got a statement from my health insurance company, Priority Healthcare of Michigan. They are raising my premiums in 2010 by 23%. This is outrageous. I blame President Obama's about to pass health care reform legislation for most of this cost increase. If we have whopping increases in premiums now, what are they going to look like when the economy is recovered? Inflation is again on the rise. I make under $30,000 a year, and I cannot afford $6,000 in premium per year I pay as a single individual. That is one tough situation, EJ.
Well, it's hard to know how he can blame President Obama for a law that isn't in effect yet, but I'm sure that's going to go on in the election year. I just have a hunch what the gentleman's politics might be, but maybe I'm wrong about that. I think one of the fears is that there may be a bunch of hikes by some insurance companies before this law takes into effect.
And,
because there are new insurance regulations that are going to come into place. My understanding is there's been talk in Congress about trying to prevent such things from happening. Beyond that, I don't know what the particular circumstance of that insurance company is. Michigan is a place where lots of people have lost their jobs. It could be, and this is a big insurance problem in general, the pool the gentleman is in could be a pool of older people, and I say this very sympathetically as somebody who's getting there, are more expensive to insure.
Norm.
Yeah, I think that there are two key points to make here. I suspect a lot of premiums will go up in Michigan simply because the pool of employed people getting subsidies from their employers has gone down with high unemployment and changes in the automobile industry and other places. But along with that, Congress does have a provision that is at least in the Senate bill that you as an insurance company will be denied access to participate in these exchanges, which is the big new element to be able to expand your base if you jack up your premiums in anticipation of the
All right, law. But how might this person in Michigan be helped by the new health care reform?
Well, under the new health care reform, very likely he would have additional options for his insurance, including on the exchange. And if he's making less than $30,000 a year, he'll get subsidies.
I would certainly hope so. Larry, I want to talk to you about what separates the House and the Senate bills on this.
Well, a lot separates the two, but I'm of the belief, and I think I'm joined by Norm and EJ, that there will be a bill, and it probably will resemble the Senate version to a much greater degree, simply because there's no margin for error in the Senate. They've got 60 votes. They need 60 votes. Many of the key senators who were involved in the final compromises have said that they're going to have to come close to the Senate version in order to make passage easier than it would otherwise be. And look, is the bill going to be perfect? Of course not. Our system doesn't permit perfect bills to ever be passed or signed into law. The older you get, the more grateful you are for incremental changes, you know, especially if they work. There's an excellent commentary on this, by the way, by Rick Hertzberg in The New Yorker this week, in which he compares the conservative criticism with the liberal criticism. If anything, the liberal criticism of the bills has been even more vicious than the conservative
but
criticism.
You know, you've got some Republicans actually questioning the constitutionality the health care reform plan. You had Orrin Hatch, Kenneth Blackwell, and Ken Klukowski write about this in the Wall Street Journal, Larry.
Yes, I think it's very unlikely that this suit, once it's actually filed, they have to wait for the bill to pass and be signed into law, but I think it's very unlikely that the courts would overturn a bill of this magnitude. Yes, you can't predict the courts, and the basis of it, obviously, is that the Commerce Clause of the Constitution prohibits Congress from mandating that people buy insurance, which I think is ridiculous, based on lots of precedents. I don't think it will succeed. I'd be interested to hear what EJ and Norm think about that.
EJ?
Well, you know, this could be the big test of how activist are the conservatives on the Supreme Court willing to be. I've had this nightmare in my head where we would relive the early New Deal period, where you had a very, very activist conservative court throw out one New Deal reform after another. It led to the big fight over FDR's effort to pack the court. And eventually some justices passed away. Roosevelt got some appointments and you got a new majority on the court. So I wouldn't be entirely shocked if some conservatives on the Supreme Court go along with those who say that the mandate to buy insurance is unconstitutional. There is a law that requires hospitals to treat people who come in, whether they have insurance or not. And I think the idea of the mandate is that if you're going to have to treat people if they're sick, and you should, then there ought to be a requirement to share the burden of that. And that's why ultimately I agree with Larry. It would take an awfully activist court to throw this law out.
How does this differ then from automobile insurance mandated throughout the country?
Well, the argument is that you don't have to drive, that you can opt out of automobile insurance by not buying a car and not driving. So this is an expansion of what we've seen before in terms of mandates. But frankly, I think you don't even have to get to the Commerce Clause. Congress has this power under the General Welfare Clause. So it, EJ is right. It would take an extraordinarily activist conservative majority. But we have a Supreme Court that may very well be poised to throw out willy-nilly 100 years plus of campaign finance law without blinking an eye, that took up an issue that had never even been raised in the case earlier. So I wouldn't put anything past this Supreme Court. The Roberts Court is dangerously unpredictable here.
That's very interesting. EJ, looking ahead, is everything going to boil down to the economy, including the 2010 elections?
Just about everything is going to boil down to the economy, especially in terms of the election. If you have a period of recovery where we begin to see job growth finally reasonably early this year, that will take some of the pressure off the Democrats, and it would obviously be the best thing that could happen for them and President Obama. If, God forbid, as some economists believe, I think they're in the minority, but some do, that this is a double dip recession and somewhere in the course of the year we start going down again, then this could be a devastating year for the Democrats. I'm of the view that this is not 1994 yet, 1994 being the year when the Republican Revolution sweeping Republican victories. There are a couple of reasons for that. One, President Obama's popularity is not that bad given that we have 10% unemployment. Gallup has him still in the low 50s. And the other is that the Republican Party could do a lot of damage to itself in the next 6 months with a lot of, I think, from the point of view of party professionals, unnecessary primaries where people will attack pretty conservative candidates for not being conservative enough. That will do two things. It will waste a lot of resources in primaries, and it will also make it impossible for conservatives to look more moderate to win middle-of-the-road voters. Governor-elect Bob McDonnell in Virginia did a magnificent job of looking like a pragmatic moderate. He's a very conservative man. He didn't have a primary, so he could do that right away. I think this could create a real problem for Republicans down the road.
Larry Sabato, what races are you particularly interested in?
Oh, God, there are dozens because, you know, you have 37 Senate seats up, not counting the Massachusetts special, which is certain to go to Martha Coakley, the Democratic candidate, in just a couple of weeks. But there are 37 Senate races. You have 37 gubernatorial contests. And, of course, all 435 House seats, though in the end there'll be somewhere around 60 semi-competitive to very competitive races. And there are just tons of them. I think we tend to focus on the big state governor's races and the key Senate contests around the country. And there are probably 12 good Senate races that are going to be highly competitive. Look, what it boils down to is this. As I mentioned earlier, everything's cyclical. It's a midterm election of a Democratic presidency in a time of economic dislocation. Even if the unemployment rate goes down, which it probably will, it's still going to be, say, 9% or, you know, 8.7% or whatever. It'll be historically high. It's just inevitable that you're going to have Republican gains in both houses of Congress, which also explains why President Obama is pushing so hard on so many fronts. He will never have it this good in Congress again. He's not going to have 60 votes in the Senate again. He's not going to have a 40-seat margin in the House again. And so it makes sense. That's why he has to push on so many different fronts. And, of course, while the economy is central, let's remember the war and peace slash terrorism issue can intervene at any point, and that could change the calculus for next November.
Larry Sabato of the University of Virginia, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. EJ, we have not mentioned the Christmas Day attempt at blowing up an airliner bound for Detroit from Amsterdam. How is the increasing threat of terrorism likely to affect the economic outlook, the sort of good feeling, bad feeling outlook within the country?
You know, I think the honest answer is I have no idea because we don't know. Are there going to be incidents? Are there going to be many incidents? Are there going to be no incidents? And I think so much depends on that. I was struck by a kind of two-step we saw in our politics. The Obama administration's initial response to this was calm and reassurance. That was interpreted by some people, certainly by Republicans, as a sort of indifference. They attacked them. Then Obama came out and said, no, we take this seriously. We're going to fix things. And you had some people in the Republican Party making a partisan issue of this. Dick Cheney, notably, nothing is better for mobilizing Democrats than Dick Cheney saying anything. So that was actually helpful to Obama. But then you saw a second step. I was struck yesterday on Meet the Press. Michael Chertoff, General Michael Hayden, worked for President George W. Bush, who basically spoke as professionals about the professionals in the Obama administration, and they really backed off any kind of partisan attack on this. They said there's a lot of continuity with our policy. General Hayden said, we made some mistakes ourselves. It's always refreshing to see anybody in public life willing to say that. And I think they overstepped the partisanship here in this case. And I think you're going to see some correction by at least some of the Republicans on that.
Norm, do you agree?
I do. And I think that there has been some cynical attempt to use this issue for partisan purposes, which I suspect will backfire. There's a larger point here, Diane, which is that we had a 9/11 commission that looked at the failures leading up to the 9/11 attack, made a whole series of recommendations, some of which were implemented. Now, more than 8 years later, it's fairly clear that the implementation has been, I can't say abominable, but it has had enormous lapses, and it's taken us this long. The security procedures in place, the intelligence sharing, what we were supposed to do when we created a Director of National Intelligence was to have somebody who could connect the dots. You know, one of the cliches like bend the cost curve, but it's there. Take the disparate pieces from different intelligence agencies and places around the world and then figure out what was there. We hadn't done that before 9/11, and it's clear now we are not doing it very well. The kind of computerization that you need to pull together 550,000 people in a watch list to do something about it, including maybe a step as simple as anybody
Googling.
Who's on that list gets taken out simply for the additional screening
sure.
rather than just blocking people from flying. But the things that we know that Google can do, that Federal Express can do in tracking instantly any package around the world, the federal government has not done. And some of this is a failure of Congress. They created a Homeland Security Department that remains an ungovernable behemoth, and they do not do oversight well.
And President Obama is scheduled to have a meeting tomorrow, I understand, on what can be done and how to do it.
And blame goes everywhere here, all across the
everywhere.
World.
We'll take just a short break. When we come back, we'll open the phones for this first program of the new year. I look forward to hearing from you.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Annie E. Casey Foundation, promoting lifelong family connections for children and youth, on the web at aecf.org. By the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, your source for what works in public education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And by the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org. This is NPR.
Foreign policy challenges in 2010. A look ahead at the threat of terrorism, the U.S. role in Afghanistan and Pakistan, Iran's nuclear ambitions, and global economic trends. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And we're back. Time to open the phones. First to Charlie in Athens, Texas. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Just a quick comment.
Sure.
We're talking about how government and Senate and the House and the President and everybody are functioning. Okay. My comment is that if you've got a population that is basically irrational, in other words, they don't study things. They act on their emotions rather than anything that they know. Then you're going to have those kinds of decisions in government, unless you have people that have a moral character to go and do what they know is right or what they believe is right, as opposed to what they believe is politically advantageous for themselves.
Larry Sabato.
Well, there's a lot of truth to that, but of course, in a small D democratic system, people have to seek votes, and they not only want to be elected, for the most part, having gone to all that trouble having put their lives on the line and their whole histories on the line, having spent millions of dollars, increasingly some of it from their own pockets, they generally want to keep the jobs they've won, and so they're much more inclined to follow popular will rather than be the Burkean trustee rather than a pure delegate. So in elective office, it's difficult to imagine the system changing anytime soon. And as far as average people are concerned, a lot of efforts are being made to increase civic education and to do a better job of civic education, because in the end, the system comes from the bottom up rather than the top down.
EJ.
I just disagree with the caller's premise. I think the human beings are imperfect, but they're not irrational in the extreme sense that he suggested. We have moments of irrationality. not everyone studies every detail of the healthcare bill. Lord knows, I think a lot of journalists haven't studied every detail of the healthcare bill. But I side with those V.O. Key, famous political scientist, Sam Popkin, a contemporary political scientist, who suggests that in the end, people make relatively rational decisions about politics, and that's why democracy works.
Charlie, thanks for your call. Now to Galesburg, Michigan. Chris, you're on the air. Go right ahead.
Thank you. I saw episode of the NewsHour on PBS. They had a woman that was talking about the provisions of the Senate health care bill. And I think once Americans see what's in it, providing that the bills are very, that's the final bill, Americans are going to support this heavily. There's a lot of consumer controls and protections, a mediation board, education for general practitioners and nurses. And I feel that next November, the Republican right wing are going to win primaries but lose general elections.
Norm Lawrence. Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
I just don't think the Democrats are going to lose as heavily as everybody's prognosticating. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for calling. Norm.
Well, you know, success on the health care bill itself, I think, would be a big plus for Democrats. It'll show that they could govern. The irony about some of the debate about this health care plan, especially coming from conservatives, is that it is not some sweeping, overreaching, crazy bill. It has pieces of parentage that you could look back, coming primarily from people like the late Senator John Chafee, moderate Republican of Rhode Island, and former Senator Dave Dernberger, moderate Republican of Minnesota, along with a substantial lineage from Mitt Romney, the governor, former governor of Massachusetts. Much of this is patterned on the Massachusetts plan. It is a managed competition bill that will not in the end have a public option. It will rely on private insurance. It will have a mandate to try to expand insurance. It will have a lot of features in it, as Chris suggested, that are not crazy features. The trouble politically is that it's going to get phased in over several years, and some pain and disruption may occur before a lot of the benefits will. That's partly to control the costs. But making sure that people understand, including those who already have insurance, that as you begin to do away with pre-existing condition limitations, with annual and lifetime limits, as you begin to provide a cushion for people who lose their jobs, where COBRA now is not a very good one, where you can have some guarantees, that will help. How much it'll help in 2010 is an open question.
I think that's right. And I think the unpopularity of this bill in some of the polls, I don't think reflects on what's in the bill, because a lot of people still aren't sure what's in the bill yet. I think it reflects how ugly the legislative process often is. And there was, at least somebody will study this in more detail, but there appeared to be some pattern that the more the legislative process was in the news, the more people had doubts about the bill. Once it's passed, this legislative process is gone and people can actually look at what's in the bill and make a judgment.
To St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning, Joanne.
Good morning. I'm afraid I'm calling because I'm deeply, deeply pessimistic, not only about 2010, but beyond. And I'll tell you why, and I'd love your guest comments. Just seems to me that under Reagan, and it accelerated under Bush, too, the individual became king, and it became perfectly okay to delegitimize and defund anything public, education, transportation, health care, anything. And that's led, I think, to a real weakening of the social contract and this sense of common good. And then when you add to that some tax and regulatory policies under both of those presidents that shifted so much of the risk for major life events like retirement and illness and things from the community to the individual, you leave individuals unable to buy the goods and services because they have to pay for all these other things. So it leaves people like me unable to buy the goods and services that run our economy. My budget plan these days is very simple. Don't buy anything.
Joanne,
and finally,
tell me, are you currently employed?
I am, and I'm deeply grateful for it, but at $20,000 a year less than I was making 2 years ago.
I see. And was that because your company downsized or asked?
Yes,
yeah. And do you currently have health insurance?
I do, for which I'm deeply grateful. And I just I do want to add one more factor. I think we've got lobbyists writing legislation, and I'm not even sure that we have a fully representative democracy anymore. But, yes, I'm in much better shape than many people I know, and I'm very deeply grateful, but in a much worse financial position than I was a couple of years ago. And I'd love your comments.
Surely. Go ahead, E.J.
Well, I agree with that very astute analysis, and I think I disagree a little bit with the conclusion. There's a brilliant young scholar, at least young relative to me, called Jacob Hacker, who wrote a great book called The Great Risk Shift, which is very much about what the caller described of a shift of risk from corporations. We had a large corporate welfare state in the country and the government to the individual. I think that's all right. I think that we are now going through a period of reaction against that. And I think one of the challenges to President Obama, and he picks this up once in a while in speeches, is to defend the idea that a certain amount of provision by the community is actually good for individuals. You know, another way to put it is a certain amount of communitarianism is good for individualism. He's got to make that case, but he's really only going to make that case if he can show government works. And I think it's always the challenge to Democratic presidents who believe in community provision of some services to show not only they can pass them through Congress, but that they can actually make these systems work. And then they are enduring, and FDR managed to do that.
What about the question of re-regulation? So many of those regulations that seem to benefit the individual seem to protect the individual from the kind of corporate collapse that we've seen the last few years. Is that re-regulation likely to be a priority for President Obama, Norm?
I think it becomes the next priority right after health care passes. Interestingly enough, the Senate appears to be providing a model of bipartisanship as it writes a financial regulation bill. Chris Dodd, the Democrat from Connecticut, and Dick Shelby, the Republican from Alabama, have managed to find some common ground and have parceled out different elements of financial re-regulation to pairs, unlikely ones, of Democrats and Republicans on their committee. And we may very well get a kind of balanced financial re-regulation. I think a part of the reason is that Republicans don't see this as providing the same political fodder that health or climate change do in terms of drawing lines in the dust. At the same time, I think it's important to say, Diane, that one of the dilemmas for Democrats now being in power is to keep the system from melting down. They worked out alliances with banks, with big business, with big investment firms that left them on the wrong side as far as a lot of Americans feel. Now they're trying to make an adjustment. They're doing it through the regulation of bonuses, which is at best an imperfect process. They're doing it through some of the rhetoric. But if you have a public that believes that the administration is more on the side of protecting bankers from the vicissitudes of this economy than protecting Joanne and people like her,
exactly,
you got a big political problem.
Here's an email from David who says, I just listen with disbelief as EJ blame Republicans for the partisanship in Congress. A more even-handed assessment is that partisanship is so strong because Democrats are overreaching their mandate. Many great things could have been achieved with some Republican support if Democrats had simply scaled back the breathtaking scope of their legislation. Norm Ornstein, what's your reaction?
Well, look, partisanship is there on both sides. There's no doubt about it. The breathtaking is not a word that I would use in this case. Go back to that health care bill. It is a moderate Republican middle-of-the-road bill, basically. It'll make significant changes, but it is incremental change. It's not a single-payer system. It's not a government-run plan. So put that out on the table. The climate change bill, imperfect as it is, basically, the whole notion of cap and trade is something that used to have fairly substantial bipartisan support, and it got watered down a lot along the way. Even if we talk about health care, the attempt of the Gang of Six, so-called, to bring Republicans into the process, including conservative Republicans like Mike Enzi and Chuck Grassley, and incorporate into the bill, and a lot that's there in that bill comes from those individuals, and then they all voted against it. And they were under enormous pressure. And you could see from the beginning, when that Gang of Six and the Finance Committee got together, the three Republicans were called down to meet with the leaders in the Senate and told, if you vote for anything that isn't supported by the vast majority of our conference, then consequences will be severe. If you look at the stimulus package, 40% of which was tax cuts, and many of those tax cuts had been proposed in amendments by Republicans, added to the bill, and then they voted against it. I think you have to make the case here that the minority decided early on that its approach to the legislative process was going to be united opposition to what this administration was doing. Bring them down that way, and they may succeed politically.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Tell me about Ben Nelson, Larry Sabatow, and the kind of pressure he is under from both sides of the aisle in terms of the health care bill.
Sure. He's a classic moderate, Diane, and of course, he's one of the most successful Democrats to come out of a heavily Republican state, Nebraska, other than perhaps former Senator Kerry. Ben Nelson was a two-term governor of Nebraska, built his reputation that way, got elected in 2000 in a squeaker against a weak Republican simply because Nebraska is so Republican and voted overwhelmingly for George W. Bush in the first election. He's been in the Senate. Now he's in his second term. He comes up again in 2012. He's one of those Democrats who always has to worry when the cycle changes. As the cycle becomes more Republican, he becomes more endangered. At the same time, he's a Democrat for a reason. He believes in certain principles of the Democratic Party. He didn't want to be the senator who killed health care reform. He made the best compromise he could on behalf of his state and on behalf of his principles, really, and became that 60th vote. Of course, becoming the 60th vote, he's become the lightning rod. He's already got ads being run against him. He's run an ad himself defending his vote, and he's going to have a very tough race for reelection in 2012. But I think he'll stick with the Democratic compromise because at this point, Democrats have to pass health care reform for the reasons Norm and EJ have already suggested. They don't have a choice. The Republicans in November will be energized either way. If health care goes down, they will have tasted blood. If health care passes, they're going to be angry. They're going to turn out in large numbers. For Democrats, if health care doesn't pass, you're never going to get those millions of Obamacrats who turned out in 2008 to come out in a midterm election. There'll be no reason for them to.
EJ.
I agree with that, which is why I do think they're going to pass health care reform. And by the way, getting those so-called Obama surge voters, particularly the young voters who turned out in such large numbers in many states, is essential for the Democrats and is going to be very difficult because young people, partly because they move around a lot, don't turn out in midterm elections in the same numbers. So turnout is key to midterm elections, and part of your base is critical to that turnout. But just quickly on Ben Nelson, one of the things I noticed is a lot of his colleagues, much more liberal than he, have a lot of respect for Ben Nelson because they say, look, he is a moderate conservative. That's who he is. He represents a very conservative state. They felt that he dealt with them on the level in terms of saying, this is where I can go and I can't go any farther. And I think Larry's absolutely right. The critical choice he had to make was I going to be the guy to kill health care reform? And he decided he did not want to be that person.
Norm.
Well, that's exactly right. But remember, this is not over and done with yet. We have to come back with a conference report. And that conference report still is going to need 60 senators. So the deal that Ben Nelson cut may not be one that sticks, and he is getting a little bit nervous.
And there are a lot of people angry about that deal, even those in Nebraska who say, you know, we don't want to be known as the state that got this trade-off for Ben Nelson's vote.
Well, you know, what's interesting there is that the Republican governor of Nebraska complained about how this was hurting Nebraska in terms of Medicaid, and Nelson fixed it. And now he's saying, well, if the governor doesn't want it, all he has to do is tell me. I did it because he asked me to. If he tells me not to, we'll take it out.
Last word from Norman Ornstein. He's resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. You've also heard E.J. Dionne of the Brookings Institution. He writes a column for the Washington Post. And Larry Sabato, founder and director of the Center for Politics at the University of Virginia. Thank you all so much.
Thank you. Happy new decade, if I can say that.
Happy new decade to all of you.
And happy 50th anniversary, Diane.
Thanks so much. And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.